The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So, thank you, and good evening again. Tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about this short, tiny little conversation that's between the Buddha and somebody else that's preserved in the Pali Canon in the Buddhist scriptures. It's the very first sutta, very first discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, that is the connected discourses. So all a collection of discourses that are about a similar topic. And in this sutta, somebody asks the Buddha, how did you cross the flood? Generally, we can understand that this a person who crosses the flood, quote-unquote, is somebody who is considered to be awakened, to be enlightened. So it makes sense that somebody would ask the Buddha, how did you do it? Presumably because they wanted to practice in a similar way. But what does this mean, this idea of flood, like to cross the flood? And there's in the suttas, there's a number of different interpretations about this. But I think that there's a number of different ways we can interpret it and make it relevant for our lives. And one is that maybe a flood is something that feels like it's overwhelming us, that we feel like, oh, it's about to overwhelm us, or maybe even is overwhelming us, but that we are afraid we might drown under. And of course, when I think about floods, I think about they're also unexpected. So there's, you know, maybe they're not 100% unexpected when there's big rains or tsunamis or something like this, but usually, as opposed to when the tide goes up and down, you know, a flood is something that's big and the water's going, not where we expect it to go, or something like this. So that's one way we can understand a flood, something that's overwhelming us and maybe was unanticipated. And to cross over is to maybe not fall under the water, not to get pulled under by it. Another way we might understand that the flood is that which sweeps us away from where we want to be, has a certain amount of current and a certain amount of movement that we're not able to resist or not able to not be pulled away with. So it has a certain direction in which we're being thrown off balance perhaps by this by the flood. Another way we might understand the flood is an obstacle, something that impedes where we want to go. That's something that's like getting in the way. Often, you know, to cross over the flood, it implies that you're on a dry spot and you want to go to another dry spot, and there's this flood in the middle, this thing that's an obstacle, that's a hindrance perhaps. Literally in the Buddhist sense of a hindrance, but also maybe just in the more general sense of something that's preventing or hindering you from getting to where you want to go. So this question of how did you cross the flood is, you know, how did you not get overwhelmed by life? How did you go where you wanted to go, not get inhibited from where you wanted to go? So in response to this question, how did you cross the flood, the Buddha responds by saying, by not halting and by not straining. By not halting, not stopping, and not straining, not struggling, maybe, or, you know, not working too hard. And so then when he was queried further, person asks the Buddha, well, what do you mean? You just talked about these two opposites, these two different things, by not stopping and not straining. Well, how does that help you cross the flood? And the Buddha responds by saying, when I came to a standstill, I sank. When I struggled, I got swept away. It is in this way, by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood. Yeah, so not halting and not straining. The Pali words for these are kind of obscure words that aren't so common in the Pali canon. They're a little bit difficult to translate. For those of you who care about these things, it's apatitta and anayua. And so what are some other, we might look at what some other translators have done for translating this, or we might just think about this for ourselves. I'll start off with what some other translators have done. They have said, kind of poetically, which I actually kind of like, without tarrying and without hurrying. So without not in any hurry. To tarry is to be in the opposite of a hurry, right? It's to just like take your time, and to hurry is to maybe be a little bit negligent or to be in a rush or something like this. By not tarrying, not hurrying. Another translator says, without staying in place nor pushing forward. So it's the similar idea of not standing still and yet not pushing forward. So there might still be some movement, but there isn't some pushing forward. And the last translation I'll talk about here is neither standing nor swimming. I kind of like this one. We don't hear about swimming that much in the Buddhist teaching. So I love swimming. So, but they're saying, I cross the flood by not standing and not swimming. But we can see how they're just talking what it isn't. But what was it that the Buddha actually did to cross the flood? What might we do to cross the flood? What are some specific things that we might do? So there's a few interpretations. It's not said, I should say, this is the end of the conversation. It's very short. But there's a few things we can do that might be the think about this and to unpack it and how we might use this to support us in our practice and the floods that we might find ourselves with. One thing that I really appreciate about this is the saying is that when I halted, or when I came to a standstill, I sank, and when I struggled, I got swept away. So this is pointing to trial and error. This is pointing to experimentation, exploring. Nobody told the Buddha do exactly this. He had to figure it out on his own. So it wasn't that he just had to follow exactly what his teacher said or adopt some particular belief and then everything would be fine. No, he had to find what happens if I stand still here. Oh, I'm sinking. Okay, that's not the right thing to do. What happens if I struggle? Oh, I'm getting swept away. Okay, that isn't the right thing to do. So this spirit of exploration or experimentation and pointing to direct experience. Maybe we can learn from seeing others when they are standing still, maybe to see how they're sinking. But for many of us, we need to have this experience ourselves, like, oh, this is what happens when I do this. So again, he doesn't say what exactly he did, but it did point to avoiding the extremes. So not one extreme or the other, but doing something else. So we might say that the Buddhist teachings are filled with these types of things, including, for example, rather than grasping or really clinging and holding on to something really tight, I want this, I need this, I have to have this in order to be a source of lasting happiness for me, Or other than like putting, shoving things away, having a sense of aversion, turning away from, I can't have this, get this away from me. So rather than trying to pull things in or push things away, we can have a third thing, a third way, and that is equanimity. That is an uprightness, a balance, and not disinterest and not disconnected, but not leaning too far forward and not leaning too far back, not leaning forward at all, not leaning back at all. So instead, to have some balance, to have some centeredness. And that can come from seeing the bigger picture. It can also come from experience. I know that I've had, for me, with some retreat experience, and many of you, if you've done some retreat experience, you might have this idea too, that the first few days of a retreat often can be unfolded in a particular way. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. The body's not used to sitting, and the mind wants to be doing whatever it was doing before it was on retreat. But there's a lot of people who know, like, oh yeah, okay, I just know the day, first day, I feel tired, and the second day, my body's is bothering me, but usually by day four, I feel fine. So because they know that, they have this experience, I have this experience, then it's easier to be equanimous about feeling tired on day one or having an uncomfortable body on day two, so for example. But we just know this from experience. So that's one way in which we can have some equanimity, to have some balance in the midst of whatever's happening. It's just, oh, I've been here before. I recognize this, have some familiarity with it. I know that it will shift or change. Everything shifts or changes. So that's just an example of a third way, equanimity being between the two extremes of grasping or aversion. And we can gain equanimity sometimes with familiarity, and allow to have this acceptance with what's happening without a passivity. Maybe another third way could be, instead of a third way between restlessness, in which there's a lot of energy and feeling like there's no way I can stay sitting here during this meditation period, I have to jump up and do something. I have certainly had this, it's quite crazy sometimes that I remember in the beginning of my practice having this feeling like, you know, sitting to meditate at home and like, oh no, it's really important that I finish that thing. Oh, I forgot about that email or whatever. And, you know, just jumping up and doing it. So having this sense of restlessness, or the opposite extreme, not being able to stay awake, right? Falling asleep. But might there be a third way between these two extremes of restlessness, too much energy, falling asleep, torpor, not enough energy? And the third way might just simply be mindfulness. What might it be to just notice the restlessness, feel the energy bouncing around, maybe the mind is spinning? What might it be like to just notice kind of the drowsiness and the fogginess in the mind and the kind of a lack of a crispness maybe with the experiences? So this is another example of something that might be a third way between the two extremes. And so you might say, well, maybe there's a third way, but maybe there's also a middle way. A middle way between the extremes. I think for those of you who have been around the Dharma scene, probably are familiar with the story of the Buddha's, his path to awakening. So he was said to have been, the tradition holds that he grew up as a prince, and he had a very sheltered life in a palace with experiencing essentially nothing but pleasurable experiences, and really secluded and sequestered from anything that might be unpleasant. And then when he was young, he became restless and left the palace and went out for a chariot ride and discovered people, an old person, a sick person, and a dead person, old age, sickness, and death. And under the impact of this, of seeing what he hadn't seen before, he became determined to find a solution to unpleasantness, to suffering, to difficulties, to dukkha. And so he left the palace and became a mendicant, practicing. Eventually, he took up with five ascetics and practiced extreme asceticism, some self-mortification and inflicting himself with pain or starving himself or holding his breath. Some kind of gruesome descriptions of some of the practices that he was doing, believing that this was going to be a way in which to end suffering. It's going to be a way to find a solution. So again, we see the Buddha trying some things. Pleasure, life of all pleasure, didn't lead to an end of suffering. And some practicing extreme asceticism didn't end suffering. He still had suffering. So he had gone from the extreme of pursuing pleasure to the extreme of eschewing all pleasure. And in fact, maybe even pursuing some pain. And it wasn't until he had abandoned both of these that he was able to become awakened. And maybe it's not surprising then, the first teaching that he gives is about the middle way. Not all about pleasure, all about not pleasure. And he provided some instructions specifically about the middle way. What is the middle way? It's the Eightfold Path between indulgence, self-indulgence, and self-mortification. But the Eightfold Path, for those of you who are not familiar with it, it has eight elements, but we can summarize it with three buckets or categories. Practicing with ethics, practicing with the mind, and practicing with wisdom, growing wisdom, cultivating wisdom. And these three different types of practices kind of inhibits this, maybe we might even say a stagnation that happens if you're just pursuing pleasure, and when you're pursuing like asceticism, then this real concern with the body, if the body's not taken care of, then you can't cultivate the mind. And the Buddha discovered, right, that the way to awakening was with cultivating the body, the mind, and practicing ethics. For those of you who know this, sila, samadhi, panya. He called this the middle way. We might also call it a third way. But also, this idea of a middle way maybe is more explicitly when we talk about effort. I think many of you are also familiar with this saying about where the Buddha gives a teaching to somebody who was a musician with a stringed instrument, and the instruction that to apply just the right amount of effort in the same way that the strings on a string instrument are not too tight and not too loose. So to practice in the middle, not too tight and not too loose. So this idea of noticing that sometimes there are extremes, and we go to extremes, whether it's with our behavior or with our views or with the way in which we approach things. One thing that it highlights is that most of, maybe all of our experiences are on a spectrum. And so that we can move away from this dyad, this binary of, you know, this or that, or lights are on or the lights are off. That, of course, is a binary, but that the that our practice happens along a spectrum. For example, we might sometimes say, "Oh, I wasn't concentrated at all," but can we see how maybe with a meditation period, it's a movement towards more settledness, more collectedness, or maybe it's a movement another direction towards some distraction. But we're never completely 100% one way at the extremes, but the practice is to be in the middle and just to recognize that that's what practice is a movement one direction or the other. The risk is if we grab onto these binary thinking, then it can be discouraging, or that's, oh, okay, I'm not concentrated, for example. I'm not mindful at all, I'm completely distracted. Instead, if we start to think like it's a spectrum, and where am I on the spectrum, kind of helps us to maybe not grab on to a particular idea of things. Oh, not concentrated. As opposed to feel into experience. Oh yeah, okay, so I'm not so collected here, but I can see where maybe the body has a certain amount of collectedness, but the mind doesn't. Or maybe it could be that the mind is not moving so, isn't so distracted or fragmented, but the body might feel really restless and want to move or something like this. So to let go of the ideas of the extremes is to highlight how things are a spectrum, our experiences are a spectrum, and to think in terms of a spectrum helps us to get away from an idea about what's happening and more to feel into what's happening. So I talked about distracted versus concentrated. Maybe we could say another is... an experience is to be filled with ill will and maybe to be filled with goodwill. Have these extremes, hatred and love, or we can use a number of different words for these two ends of the spectrum. But something that Gil has been talking about a lot lately is, what about something that's about care? So maybe it's not one end of the spectrum or the other, but care, which implies a certain amount of connectedness and attentiveness. And so rather than being one end of the spectrum, you can say, oh yeah, okay, so I'm moving towards care. Now that I'm thinking about this, maybe this isn't the best example. Maybe this is more like a third way. But that's exactly what is the practice forward, is to explore and experiment. What are our experiences? Another advantage of letting go of these ideas of the extremes is that whenever we're at an extreme, well, when we're clearly at one end, whether, for example, it's like we're really holding on tight or really pushing away, there's always a really strong sense of self that's involved with when we're at the extremes. This sense of, I need to do this, I have to do this, I should do this, I must do this. Or there's a strong sense of, you know, I'm over here and everybody else is over there. Or a strong sense of limits or boundaries. And of course, boundaries are important, but what I'm talking about, like this separateness, maybe is a better word. So when we are holding on to the extremes, there's a really strong sense of me here, as opposed to a more relaxed, soft view. We're not trying to prop up or defend a particular version of ourselves, but instead we're able to just feel into what's happening here. What is the experience? And that, of course, is how we cross the flood. We cross the flood by feeling, sensing what's happening, doing some experiments, we could call it, some exploration, what makes sense for us. Of course, we have all the Buddhist teachings to help us for guidelines. And as best we can, as much as it makes sense for them, is to soften, loosen, let go of a strong sense of self, which goes with some clinging, some really tightness, but instead to, can there be a certain relaxation, like, okay, what needs to be done here? What's the next thing to be done? As opposed to, oh no, I'm going to drown, I'm going to get lost, I'm going to be under the water. Instead, can we like, okay, what's happening here? What's the right next thing to be done? So in this way, by not halting and by not straining, we can cross the flood. And then we can help others cross the flood, either by being an exemplar, or maybe we could share some of what we've learned through our ways that we've worked with some of our difficulties when we've been feeling overwhelmed. So may our practice together this evening be of benefit for us and for all beings everywhere. Thank you.